Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's L-O-N-E-S-T-A-R Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big.
Good day. This is the making of the John Batchelor Show. I am he. I'm joined by my good colleague, Thaddeus McCullough, former member of Congress, now at American Greatness from the great state of Michigan. Go through some of the international headlines and then come home to the stories that are the politics of the midterm election as we understand them this close in. In Africa, Ebola deaths have now risen to 930. The outbreak of Ebola is spreading, according to the people watching this, the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Prevention is two jabs of prescription. It's unclear how widespread that is being offered in Africa, certainly in the big cities, for those who have available health care. In the Americas, we have news from the White House, a declaration that the Trump administration is going to impose a 50% tariff on a wide range of goods, says the London reporting. Washington accuses neighbor of engaging in unfair practices in a move that could reignite trade war. There's a lot to comment on that. The White House is pointing to states in Canada raising some of their prices on alcoholic beverages, most recently, not the federal government. In addition, the White House on Friday declared that there was going to be a tariff on Canada because of the wildfire smokes. That is not now being repeated. Instead, it seems that they're looking for an explanation for why suddenly 50% tariffs on all these goods, and they're saying it's alcoholic beverages. My understanding from some of the commentators is that those 50% tariffs, while will equally weight on American and Canadian consumers, it is about alcohol that America buys from Canada. They're also ruled out by the USMCA, which is still in action. So that's a trade debate that looks very much like, as is characterized by European commentators, to be a Trump administration temper tantrum, perhaps based on recent events. Unknown. I just mentioned that it's the tariff wars qualified because of the Supreme Court ruling that the original application of Liberation Day was incorrect. I note that the tariffs that the White House cited in this recent declaration are a never-used-before aspect of the famous Smoot-Hawley tariffs of the 1930s. So the Trump administration now has the credit of bringing Smoot-Hawley into the conversation again. It's always wonderful for historical review. What was Smoot-Hawley, John? Well, later. We're moving on to headlines. The Middle East, of course, is war-torn. The declaration by the Pentagon is that 100 U.S. troops have been injured in 2 weeks since the Iran war restart. We'll talk about that at length today. Donald Trump is in the White House to meet the president of Lebanon, a critical detail because Lebanon is Hezbollah and Hezbollah is Lebanon, meaning that the government in Beirut is untrustworthy. as an enforcer, but the Israel-Lebanon agreement of some weeks past, hammered out at the State Department, as I understand, is going to start an experiment right now of turning over so-called pilot zones to the protection and pursuit of the Lebanese armed forces, and the Israelis will withdraw from those areas one at a time. If it's successful the first time, there'll be a second, and second, a third. It means the Lebanese armed forces have to do what they've never done, which is disarm Hezbollah. Hezbollah doesn't invade southern Lebanon. It lives there. These are Hezbollah villages. So the Lebanese armed forces, who may also live there, are being asked to disarm the neighborhood. Unlikely. In the United Kingdom, there's a new prime minister. This is the 9th in 10 PMs, or the 8th in 9, I've lost track. This time, the PM named Burnham, Andy Burnham, comes from northern England. He's the mayor of Greater Manchester. Until now, he's the prime minister of the country. He's young. He's very energetic. I watched his speech before number 10. He bounced a lot. It was encouraging, and the cabinet is turning over. Unfortunately, what I heard from the new PM is taxes, but I didn't study the matter. I was going quickly through his speech. Taxes. Something about taxes. Lord knows there are enough taxes in England. They don't need new ones. What they need is reform of their demands on the public for the NHS and other state enterprises. However, what works on this side of the Atlantic might not work over there in terms of virtue signaling. So the new PM is in place. Coming back to the U.S., I mentioned the casualties, the KIA, and now the wounded in action in the Gulf. There is the difficulty of reporting on the Gulf. It's all fog of war. As of yesterday, the declaration we had from the Iranians and then echoed by the Houthis is that the Houthis are now being tasked or are volunteering themselves into the conflict by threatening the Red Sea and the Bab el-Mandeb, the choke point at the southern point of the Red Sea. In addition, they threaten Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia gets its oil to the world not via the Persian Gulf and the Straits of Hormuz, but via the Red Sea and the Bab el-Mandeb. Jeddah certainly is in range. So are the major port where Saudi Arabia stores its oil and ships it out. We'll see if the Houthis are making war on the oil infrastructure or on the Saudi Arabians. There's certainly some bad relations in the Gulf that complicate everything. As for the war fighting, ten nights in a row of bombing Iran with no appreciable hesitation on Iran's part, they answer by attacking infrastructure in the neighborhood. That's enough for me to bring on my colleague Thaddeus McCotter, commenting on all these matters. We'll start with foreign policy, of course, because we are at war, and there's a report on the front page of the Wall Street Journal that Pickaxe Mountain, which has been mentioned by the Trump administration over these last weeks, there's activity at Pickaxe Mountain, never bombed. It was not bombed in June of 25. That there's consistent with moving suspect nuclear weapons program material and machinery into Pickaxe Mountain, where I'm told it's unbombable by conventional means. Thaddeus, a very good day to you. We'll begin immediately, but I wanted your thoughts on the foreign affair of the U.S. at war. Is that a debate that you see among your colleagues, that we're at war or not at war, or does everybody accept that this is a war with Iran and that we fight to win? I'm unclear some days whether the Trump administration conducts itself appropriately for a war. For example, the president seemed to be in a festive mood over the weekend when he attended the World Cup. Didn't seem very grave or focused at all on the war fighting. Good day to you, Thaddeus.
Good day to you, John. Well, as we've seen since Vietnam and going forward, the continual blurring of the line between what constitutes a strike, what constitutes a conflict, what constitutes an actual war. There were no declarations of war with Iraq or Afghanistan. There were authorizations of force. So we've created a gray zone that in many ways looks like Detroit after the wildfires came over it. Everything's gray and hazy, and there is no clear definition. All you know is that you're not in a good place. That's kind of where we are with Iran. I would argue that when the men and women of the United States Armed Forces are falling in the defense of their country, that constitutes a war. That it, when you are engaged with kinetic activity with an enemy, that is a war. Because you're asking men and women not only to put their lives on the line, but to take lives in the defense of the country. As an aside, that's why I would have always stayed with the term the Department of Defense rather than the Department of War, because there has to be a moral dimension to what you're doing. Put that aside, I think you're seeing Americans in their day-to-day activities consider this in many ways, much like we saw with Iraq, Afghanistan, unlike Vietnam. The big key distinction being the draft in Vietnam, I would argue, making it more salient, obviously. But you're seeing people go about their daily lives where this is almost an abstraction unless you have relatives, family members, or loved ones serving in the United States Armed Forces, especially overseas in the theaters. So to many people, it becomes a political issue. It becomes an abstraction almost to the sense where affordability and other issues are more central to how you're going to vote and how you deal and how you address political issues. Those are your concerns. So I think that you're seeing that. I think the members of Congress are very typical of the average American. They're looking at affordability. They're looking at domestic issues. And this remains an important issue, but it is not in the forefront of their thoughts, and they just hope that it ends quickly.
My memory of wars like this is the metaphor is quagmire. Do you measure that the Trump administration is in a quagmire in the Middle East, or does it have a way out of this?
I don't use quagmire because they tend to look at things like that as a talking point or a pejorative. If you want a strategic assessment, they're trying to find a way that the attacks on Iran to prevent them from having a nuclear program. And I would argue that in many ways it was an attempt at regime change. Put that aside. They're trying to find a way to justify the action with the result. And their messaging at times has been very confusing, both to the American people and to the Iranian regime. The Iranians, I think, have been rather consistent in their approach. They're engaging in asymmetrical, unconventional warfare, attacking anything they can, even their neighbors, to disrupt the American economy, to bring political pressure to bear on the United States, to lower their intensity of the conflict and maybe to end it. And get pressure from the other Gulf states in that, as well as the American electorate, worried about gas prices, et cetera. So I think that they've been rather consistent. I think the administration has not laid forth a consistent end game to this, to the American people, that will justify the sacrifices. And I think that that's the biggest concern that we have right now is how do we know we're making progress over there and what constitutes the ultimate goal so the American people can get behind the war effort?
We'll begin immediately with our remarks for the show. I want to start with domestic politics. Reverse it upside down. We just talked foreign policy. I want to start with domestic politics because that is an area I have no personal experience. I just read. You have very personal experience about what do you do this close to a midterm? What do you do for recruit? What does a party do to recruit, to raise money? What do individual incumbents do this close to a midterm? It is not a presidential year. You're not seeing the same scale of turnout and money being spent. So I want to start on the midterm, and especially the price of gasoline. That is one way to translate the many firefights that we read about in the Middle East, not only Strait of Hormuz, but also Israel and Hamas and Hezbollah. All those threats seem to affect the price of oil, or can, And right now I see a map showing that the West and New England are under the burden of $4 gas. Pennsylvania is more than that, according to this chart. And we're early days into this new round of fighting or bombing or missile firing in the Middle East. So we'll start with the price of gasoline and then move on to what is to be done. I also want to include the president's remarks last Thursday night, which I had anticipated was a presentation about the restart of the war. It was not. It was odd, and we'll touch on that, and then we'll come to how the American people are signaling to members of Congress what is to be done. Is it about tariffs? Is it about manufacturing? Is it about growing the economy? Is it about war fighting? Certainly, is it about the midterm election and the presentation of both parties? I hear a lot of, I'm not going to vote. So there's usual discouragement on both sides. We'll begin right away, Thaddeus. Thank you. 5, 4, this is the making of the John Batchelor Show, about to become the thing itself. 3, 2, 1. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome my colleague and friend of many years, Thaddeus McCotter, American greatness, former member of Congress from the great state of Michigan. We're looking at the politics of the moment as we approach a midterm election that has an historical metric. The party in the White House coming to the first midterm after the election, generally speaking, meets disappointment in terms of the House of Representatives and also the Senate, but chiefly the House. The vote goes the way for the other party, sort of a balancing act. Historically, that is accurate, but it is not predictive. It's just a trend. So I mention, for the Republicans to lose seats in this midterm would not be anything but ordinary trends after a presidential election. That being said, I begin with the price of gasoline. I have a chart in front of me of the states of the United States. It appears that New England and the West are leading in terms of a price of a gallon of gasoline. Leading is a misleading word. There are the prices. California is well over $5. And New England is around $4. Pennsylvania is very hot, $4 to $5 higher. So these are states that will very much be influenced, very much carry the weight of the midterm election. Pennsylvania is a purple state, a swing state, goes back and forth, has for the last several cycles. That is a very good day to you. The price of gasoline, we can connect it eventually to the fighting in the Middle East, but it just looks like a burden on the American taxpayer, a burden on the American working class, especially people who are living on paychecks, see that price of gasoline not only at the pump, but in the price of food and the price of all things that people shop at for Costco. Is that something in your experience that is significant to members of Congress as they campaign? Do they need to have a response for people complaining about gasoline prices going up again? Good day to you, Thaddeus.
Good day to you, John. Well, it's an indicator and a symbol, and politically it's a very charged issue, and the Democrats are grabbing on it, seizing upon it, as they should, to attack Republicans. I've seen billboards driving down I-94 that talked about this is the price of gas before Trump's war. This is the price of gas after Trump's war. You also see signs that talk about your electricity bills. Now, regarding the electricity bills, there were the Democrats in Michigan when they had the majority and the governorship. They still do have the governorship. They passed laws that would make more green our energy infrastructure, and everybody warned them that that was going to lead to higher energy prices. So the Democrats not only are using the high gas prices as a symbol of the failure of the administration to address inflation overall and affordability issues, are also laying some of the blame falsely upon this administration for things that they themselves have done. It's very crafty, and right now it seems to be working very well. It's going to be very difficult for Republicans to address affordability issues. And I think them going home, the earlier they go home, I think is a bad sign, because they're not going to be able to say that they're in Washington actually doing anything. So to a certain extent, when you do things that you if you leave early, you're basically sending up the signal that we're done for now, and we've done everything we can, and now it's time to go defend what we've done. If you haven't done much, there's not much to defend, and there's not much to articulate. So to a certain extent right now, the Republicans are really stuck because the price of gas, the number one symbol of the affordability issues, is not likely to come down anytime soon. And so it becomes very difficult for them in the swing seats to make an argument that 2 years ago we reelected President Trump. We sent the Republicans into a majority to deal with the inflationary and fiscal mess left by the Democrats, and it either has not gotten better or it's gotten worse. And so how do you convince voters, especially independent voters, that a change is not necessary when the last change they tried clearly has not, to their mind, worked?
Tariffs. That was a very big story in 2025. It has not been top of the pile recently because of the war fighting and the war restart and the conflicts, but tariffs are there. The Trump administration is now using tariff language directed at Canada, oddly, using a never-before-invoked caveat of the Smoot-Hawley Act of the Great Depression of the 1930s.
Yeah, one of the key spurs of the Great Depression.
Yes, so Smoot-Hawley is in the news. We get to say that it was passed by Congress and signed by Hoover thinking it was going to protect Americans. What it did was it started an international trade war that took what was instability and doubt in Europe and turned it into a catastrophe. The beggar thy nation was first before armies crossed borders. So the old saying, when goods don't cross borders, armies do. That's the old saying. Well, that happened in the 1930s after Smoot-Hawley. There were other mistakes made. For example, the Federal Reserve Bank at the time thought the problem was too much money, so they raised rates, which is exactly the wrong direction when you have doubts about your economy. But Smoot-Hawley was then and is now a shorthand of saying they pretty much did the wrong thing in the Hoover administration, and it looks like the Trump administration doesn't mind being associated with Smoot-Hawley with this one little detail about tariffs on alcoholic beverages from Canada sold to the U.S. That's what it's about. And it's not a federal tax in Canada. It's a state-by-state tax, as I understand it. It's wine.
Province by province.
Thank you. Province. Correct. It's a province tax. But the suggestion is that the U.S. needs to tame Canada. Now, aside from that, the headlines in the financial...
How's that work in 1812, John?
It doesn't work, but I...
Taming Canada, yes.
Smoot-Hawley is not something you want to explain when you're running for election. Trump prepares fresh tariff barrage with 10% levies set to expire. U.S. president to renew trade war after Supreme Court threw out reciprocal duties. In other words, we're going to start all over again, but it's nowhere near as easy for the president to wake up and say, 50% here, 20% there, we've got a deal here. This new invocation requires hearings, lengthy conversations, public meetings, a lot of investigation. It's not immediate, it's a trend. I mention, that is, because tariffs were a large story in 25. Do you see the voters or the members of Congress bringing them up again in the campaign? It's not easy to translate them.
I think with tariffs, most Americans measure them by the results. If prices go up on things, I don't like the tariffs. If prices go down and more jobs return to the United States, then I like them. And then to a certain extent, they're an abstraction. You just got to measure them by concrete results. When you look at the way that the tariffs are employed in many ways by this administration, it becomes almost a default response for how to punish individuals that you don't like them, but you don't like what they do. So that when we look at Canada, Detroit being one of the most hard hit areas due to the quality and the air pollution caused by the wildfires, we were very, very hard hit. You would walk outside and it felt like you were living in a bonfire. So I can say that there was very great animus in this area regarding how Canada handled it. We believe it was a failure of proper forestry management, a failure to have tools such as water dropping planes and other firefighting equipment on hand to deal with this. But that does not necessarily mean that, so that the Trump administration felt that they had to address this for places like Detroit, places like Chicago, places like Minneapolis, St. Paul, New York City, other places, Buffalo, that were hit by the smoke from the wildfires in Canada. So to appease them, they will talk about using the tariffs. They will use them in a not merely a retaliatory fashion, but a punitive fashion. And I don't think that that's very, that's what they were intended to do. And I don't think that they were intended to, that they will have great effect in dealing with that. These were issues that should have been handled in a different way rather than through tariffs. And to a certain extent, that those who believe that tariffs are necessary to help defend the United States against unfair trade practices, which is what their purpose should be, find that this actually weakens the support for them and weakens the argument when they're applied to things that are better handled or actually should be handled other ways.
Thaddeus McCotter, American Greatness in the Great State of Michigan, commenting on the domestic stories, whether price of gasoline, the price of real estate, the price of food, or the international domestic stories, tariffs. We're going to turn to the politics of the moment. The president's presentation about an election passed last week raises questions that don't have easy answers. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor with my colleague and friend Thaddeus McCotter, former member of Congress. He writes at American Greatness. He's in the great state of Michigan. Last week, Thaddeus, the President of the United States made a national address that was presented in the news but not covered closely by the networks. And the anticipation was that the President was going to address the restart of fighting, of bombing, of risk in the Middle East to do with the Islamic Republic of Iran. That was not the point of the presentation, I learned. The president wanted to, or intended to, and did present a completely new argument to me about the 2020 election on the basis of what the president said was new information, new evidence that he was pointing to. The president also said in the course of his presentation that no one has a more corrupt or untrustworthy election than the United States. It was an odd statement. The whole thing was odd and raises the question about the president's trustworthiness in office. Since then, I've stayed away from it as much as possible because it was so odd. It suggested instability at some point, and then again, it was discontinuous. The way I think of it to make it less threatening is C.S. Lewis's Through the Wardrobe. You enter into Narnia, where the rules are not the same as they are in the world of Oxford and Cambridge, where C.S. Lewis lived. This is a Christian fantasy of the 1930s that was very popular during the Second War. C.S. Lewis was very popular. He was on the airwaves. Narnia is a children's book, and there was something childlike about the president's repetition of 2020 being illicit, stolen, corrupt, I don't know, he had a lot of words for it. Is that something the voters can measure for this midterm? It's not a presidential election, but it is odd. And since then, members of the administration have been obliged to avoid the question about 2020, and they do dutifully, but it makes them embarrassed, I believe, and it certainly calls into question their judgment.
Oh, there's a question in there. So I think it's just rather odd that someone can get elected president of the United States twice and then complain that the system may be rigged and be horrible and untrustworthy. It seemed to work on two occasions. I think that one of the things that Donald Trump does is that he just so unhinges his opponents that it leads them to think the most crazy things. So let me just put it this way. Politics is politics. So what you're seeing with the president is you're worried about a midterm election. So you're worried about your turnout. So you start to talk about, it's going to be a tough climb there. All these things are against us and we need everybody to turn out. Unfortunately, I think that by trying to talk about how we have to turn out using 2020 as an example, where the Democrats, like in Michigan, our Secretary of State was found by a courts to have gone beyond her authority to help expand, and I would argue in a partisan fashion, the election. But these things happen all the time. And both parties want to gain partisan advantage in elections. I get that. So by you basically have, it is counterproductive to tell people that the system is rigged or doesn't work, because at that point, then you're diminishing. You're saying to yourself, well, if it's rigged, then why should I vote? So that becomes counterproductive for him to do that. I think it's unfortunate for the President of the United States to say that our system is the most untrustworthy electoral system in the country. Because, again, that begs the question, well, you got you elected. Was that a problem or was that a feature or a bug of the system? And then if you look at it, what they're laying out, then the administration is trying to lay out. It's very crafty. And he's done this in 2016, 2020, and even 2024. When you talk about, well, the system is rigged, what you've done then is you've said, well, if I beat the rig, then I've done a tremendous job. And if I lose, well, it's not my fault. It was rigged. And so I think what you're seeing is a narrative, again, being used. And this is politics. He's creating a narrative whereby he will win either way, where it's a question of if the Republicans do well, then it was the result of this administration's policies and everything else. If the Republicans do badly, well, the system was rigged and there are these problems. It wasn't this administration's fault for not handling inflation, not handling affordability, for not handling the Iran war. So that's really what he's doing. Now, we can talk about, oh, it's over the top or this or that. Just focus on what they're trying to do. That's really all you have to do. He's creating a narrative to try to cover himself in against two eventualities, in which case he will either win or he will be insulated. It's politics. And I'm not saying that I agree with it or I think it's a good thing, but that's what they're doing.
Is it a loyalty test for Republicans? I understand the Democrats can take advantage of it and make it into an existential contest and raise money. Good for them. Mm-hmm. But is it a loyalty test for the Republicans? It certainly has been in several instances of testimony for confirmation, where grown-up members of the party refuse to say, yes,
physically mature, if not emotionally or intellectually mature,
refuse to comment on the 2020 election. They're being asked to say something that is incorrect, and they refuse to say anything at all.
Yeah, I run into this all the time, and I'm like, all I can remember, the greatest loyalty you can have to this administration or to the Republican Party or to the Democrats or to the country is to say, look, the Democrats expanded, went beyond their control in 2020 where they could. In the end, the president lost and poor generals fight the last war instead of winning the current one. So if you're looking back to 2020, you're not going to win in 2026. So it's time to focus on what we have to do. Did President Trump serve in office between 2021 and 2025? No. Okay, so he lost one way or the other. He was not president for those 4 years. Joe Biden was. So let's go forward and look at how the Republicans can handle 2026. Because I'm telling you, the American public, if they watch that speech, said to themselves, this is all political stuff. I don't care. What about the price of gas? What about the price of groceries? And they just would tune this out. And they would say to themselves that a party that can't let go of when they lost in 2020 is not the party that I'm looking forward to take America into the future.
Thaddeus McCotter, American Greatness, former member of Congress, great state of Michigan. I'm John Batchelor. I'm convinced.
If we seek to open a quarrel between the past and the present, we will lose the future. Winston Churchill.
Boy, yes, 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 and yes.
I would argue that I can't understand this. If I was president and 2020 had happened to me, don't forget also the COVID restrictions and everything else that he had bought into at that point in time. But regardless, I thought Grover Cleveland, who is the only president prior to this that had served non-consecutive terms, showed incredible resilience and perseverance and an incredible control of his party to be able to do that, to be president, to lose, and then come back and win again. I would argue that even if the Democrats did horrible things to me in 2020, it's a sign of resilience and perseverance and actually is a credit to the individual. So going back and whining and complaining about it actually diminishes your stature in the eyes of most Americans, because we're like, well, you overcame an obstacle and you got even better. That's how it's supposed to happen in America. I just don't understand the constant fixation on it. You overcame that obstacle. That's what matters. Quit bitching about the obstacle.
It was so detached from reality.
Do you know what it was, John? You know what it was? I think historians will look back at this and they say, in many ways, this was the other side of the coin of Joe Biden's speech attacking MAGA with all the dark lighting and the flames or whatever. You know, this is a different circle of hell, I suppose. This is the Democratic circle of hell. This is the MAGA circle of hell. And here are the same sides of the coin. But I think that in many ways, people will look back and say, that's kind of like their version of this, I guess.
Both parties have disruptions to deal with. Mm-hmm. MAGA for the Republicans and DSA for the Democrats. And I believe that will be something that shows up in 26. It's hard now to talk about it because you don't know what that means for votes. But it's certainly the debating points in both parties.
Well, the race in Michigan between Representative Haley Stevens and Dr. Abdul El-Sayed is really heating up. And that's basically the establishment with Stevens, or the Obama Democratic establishment with Representative Stevens and the Bernie Sanders AOC DSA types with Dr. Abdul El-Sayed. I think AOC came in and endorsed him just recently as well. So that's going to be a clear indication of who has the momentum. Does it expand from New York and some of these other blue cities into a statewide Senate primary for the Democrats? It's going to be very interesting to see first week of August.
I do believe that the DSA is the Democratic outreach to the young voter. That's certainly
what AOC, yes. And AOC was part of that design, which is why the media latched onto her and put her forward. And this is, but I think the Democratic establishment was behind that because they viewed her as this is the image of what we want to put forward to young voters. But they didn't understand that she was put forward by the DSA, that the DSA was not going to be an adjunct wing of the party. It was going to try to take over the party. And as they started to rise and as they started to gain momentum, the Democratic Party establishment got caught flat-footed because they helped to create this. They helped create this with the promoting of the squad. Ironically, it was Speaker Pelosi, interestingly, it was Speaker Pelosi, who was a very, very skilled politician, who was one of the first ones to catch the wind of this because she had to deal with some of the squad members in her caucus and had to deal with AOC and my representative, Talita Rashid. So you're starting to see that she was on the front line of having to deal with this. And so now that's when I think you really started to see the pressure build, that this wasn't just a case of like the Freedom Caucus. This was a distinct challenge to the Democratic Party establishment, much more like the Tea Party was in the beginning and much like MAGA became as a challenge to the Republican establishment. And again, I think Michigan, this is going to be a key indicator of how widespread it is. Now, in terms of the youth, I think that some of the youth, again, it goes back. I don't think a lot of young men are behind in the Midwest are behind this type of thing, especially blue collar young men, vocational with their profession. I think you're also seeing a lot of these are college educated that you generally see typically with the degrees that are in non-productive areas. These are not engineers. These are not
DSA. You're talking about DSA.
These are more like the academics who believe that the postmodernists that believe to change the language it's not just they're worried about affordability, John. This class, and it's always been this way, they believe that because they have been credentialed by these wonderful institutions that they are entitled to be the elite that lead the country. And this is, they latch on to this. And it's an interesting dynamic, but we've always had these people in the country, and now they just call themselves socialists because they don't produce anything. They just want to redistribute what other people do.
Can we imagine this forward to 28? Because it seems to be very successful in 26, winning primaries in the Democratic Party. What does this mean for presidential contest?
Well, I'm looking at, the New York were congressional primaries in the city of New York, right? those were the DSA wins with Mondami's endorsement, right, those three right. that came out of there. What I'm Michigan, the Senate race in Michigan, you could not have a starker example of the DSA versus the Democratic establishment. They're lining up exactly as you would expect them to. And I think you'll get a very good indication of where each side is at, whether the establishment can hold with Haley Stevens or not. In fact, one of the ads they're running is it that Dr. Syed, Abdul Syed, El Syed cannot win. Haley Stevens is running the ad that he cannot win against, and that Donald Trump and MAGA people are supporting him with money and behind the scenes so that he'll be their nominee. I mean, we're seeing exactly this type of thing. And I think it's going to be held up as an example when the pundits finally recognize, you know, that they're here in America, in deep America, you're actually having a race that will have national implications for both parties. Because it's not just the Democrats. If the Democrats go whole hog into the DSA, it bodes very well for Republicans, because the rest of the country will recoil from it, certainly here in deep America.
Except for the MAGA element, because there is reason to believe that the MAGA element is going to discourage voting by the Republicans.
The problem with the MAGA, it's not the policies of MAGA. It's not the policies that's the problem. It's the personality of the president that is off-putting. If you stack up the policies of the DSA, it's absolutely backwards, and this is unfortunate. So the Democrats run Mondami, and he runs around smiling. Meanwhile, he has a hideous agenda behind him, socialism. But he has a big smile, and he seems to be charismatic.
Right.
So then you got Trump over here, and he's managed to make populism unpopular by dint of personality. So that's the problem. We live in crazy times.
The turnout
model. But the policies of MAGA are generally, when you poll them without telling people that these are Trump's policies, people like them.
The policy of MAGA comes down to the loyalty test to Trump. That's what it comes down to.
No, that comes down to Trump. The Congress is not passing bills saying I am loyal to Donald Trump. They're passing policies and based upon, you know, lower taxes, less government, eradicate the deep state, these types of things, more equity, less outsourcing, these types of things. People tend to like those. They want legal immigration, not illegal immigration. These types of things people vote on. They've elected him twice, despite himself.
The statement yesterday was that the party, unnamed, is asking Trump not to do the 2020 speech again.
What do you mean, unnamed? I didn't hear
As
that.
In, I don't have a name of what the party represents. In other words, Republicans asked Trump to leave out 2020 for the campaign, for the closing weeks of the campaign.
I would hope so. 2020 is 6 years gone.
Right,
but you've been reelected. You overcame your obstacle.
Yes, I agree with that. So do the Republicans who are running for reelection. Mm-hmm. They're asking the White House not to repeat last Thursday night.
Yeah, I would hope so.
There's no answer as of yet.
Well, that's a good sign, isn't it? Because usually if he doesn't want to do something, he'll tell you right up front. He's not a bashful man, John.
In addition, some of his choices for candidates have proved marginally effective. The candidate in Texas, I understand, is qualified by his previous conduct.
Look, what he did with a lot of these states, and I think this happened in Michigan as well, he would find people that seemed to be ahead or nominally ahead, and he would get behind them with his endorsement so he could stack up his primary victory numbers. Because he has to keep the members of Congress in those last 2 years, the Republicans especially, concerned about his endorsement in a primary. You saw what happened with Massey and some of the other instances. Uh-huh. So what he's saying is, even though you think I'm a lame duck, I can still come into your primary in 2028, make you miserable, and have you lose your seat unless you do what I want. It's a very canny way to go about keeping members in line for 2028. But as Iran goes forward, and as you continue to see if the gas prices stay high and if inflation continues, the popularity amongst the average Republican, they'll start to separate because the policies have failed. And they will be looking for a new leader that will implement more policies, and his endorsement may not have the command over the primary Republican primary voter that it has at this point. But what'll happen? But again, if he actually delivers on this in the last 2 years, closes strong, then he will have sway not only in primaries in 2028, but perhaps even after that, depending on how he decides to go forward with his retirement.
Will 2020 be a loyalty test for the candidates for 28?
2020 is over.
I understand that, but it's the way it's framed. You must. The way it's framed in the testimony so far is mm-hmm. that if you're a Republican going for a job in the Trump administration, you must not challenge the president's opinion of 2020, which is that it was stolen. And that's the way it comes through in the testimony to Congress. The man, I believe his name is Clayton, the U.S. attorney from New York, refused to answer the question whether Joe Biden won the 2020 election or not.
He won. The Democrats expanded they exceeded their authorities. It's been ruled by courts. They exceeded their authority, gained partisan advantage, but they won. And this happens all the time. Republicans try to expand their majorities, expand their partisan advantage in elections. This happens all the time. The president lost. We go forward. And then he overcame that obstacle, which is a tremendous amount of resilience and perseverance on his part, even despite assassination attempts. So, yeah, he wasn't president for those 4 years, so I guess you can't really argue that by any way stretch your imagination he won that election, so then you must have lost the election.
Will it be a loyalty test to declare yourself MAGA for the 28th cycle? I'm looking at the presidential contest, which starts immediately after the 26th vote. Christmas 26 will all be about the choices for 28.
Oh, it's about the choices for 28 now, basically. So I just think it's stupid. And if you have to sit there and dance around whether or not 2020 was stolen, won, or lost, or whatever, then you shouldn't be president in the first place. Or if you're a Democrat that you can't admit that you did things under COVID you shouldn't have done, well, then you shouldn't be president either. If everybody can admit that 2020 was an ugly year where people did a whole lot of things that they shouldn't have done, starting with the lockdown in general, then you really shouldn't be president of the United States. A pox on both their houses.
Yes, fair enough. And that doesn't do wonders for turnout, correct?
American people are very practical people. They understand that even if they don't like either candidate, they're going to have to vote for one. Some people just say the pox on both their houses, stay home. Some people will say, well, this house has less pox. So you don't know. We won't know if maybe there are some inspiring candidate comes down the pike, you know, with policies that make sense and, hey, let's give them a shot. Maybe he or she can do this. And maybe that increases turnout. And maybe it doesn't. But everything we're seeing now, and interestingly, somebody needs to track these reforms. Every reform I've seen in my life has wound up diminishing voter turnout. Hmm. It just keeps going down. Every reform that these people have tried to come up with to increase voter turnout has actually diminished voter turnout. And the last one was McCain-Feingold. It was going to increase competition, increase turnout, level the playing field. Now you got an era of dark money, and everybody says, well, if we're being run by billionaires, we don't even know who they are. Why does my one little vote matter? Yeah, it's great work, guys. Great work.
Are you seeing a low voter turnout for the primary in Michigan?
I think that it should be pretty high on the Democratic side.
I see.
I really think it should because of the Haley Stevens, El Sayed race. So I think that should be high. I would be surprised if it wasn't higher than typical midterm elections. That's a very important seat for them. And there are very important stakes within the party itself. And the Republican side doesn't have that type of situation here at this point.
James is running for governor. Is that correct?
He has Trump's support, which propped him up and kept him going, which is fine. You had Mike Cox drop out afterwards. He said he will support the Republican ticket in November. And you've got Perry Johnson, the 78-year-old rich guy, still running. But I don't see him getting much traction at this point after the Trump endorsement.
That is McCotter, American Greatness in the Great State of Michigan, commenting on DSA and MAGA in the 26th election and the 28th election as we go forward. This is the making of the John Batcher Show. I'm much more comfortable with foreign affairs than I am with domestic affairs. Because
you and me both.
I get it wrong when I hear it the first time. I just do. So I wait.
It's okay.
Yes. Thank you, Thaddeus. And we're going to the Roman Orchestra. I thank you all very much for watching this morning. And the day ahead is a lot of war fighting. A lot of war fighting. Quite apart from the polls, it is not at all clear in the Middle East. I have a new way of explaining it. If you're not losing, you're winning. And that is an uncomfortable fact right now for the United States. Here's the Roman Orchestra. Thank you all very much. See you in 23 hours.
Hey everybody, Lady Luck here, and we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now, all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on SpinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com, get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.